This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we continue our Where We Vote series, where you get a chance to ask questions of the candidates for office. Today, Republican Tom Foley joins us. He's the frontrunner for the party's nomination to take on Governor Dan Malloy in the fall. He's leading in the polls, and he's taken the party's endorsement into an August primary. We'd like to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Again, our phone number is 860-275-7266. You can always email us where we live at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at where we live. You can also find us on our Facebook page and on WNPR.org. The cameras of CTN are here today as well. And Tom Foley, welcome back to Where We Live.
Thanks. Good to be with you, John.
So the big news this morning is that former state lawmaker, blogger, education activist John Pelto has announced he is running for governor on a third-party ticket with teacher Ebony Murphy. He's been very critical of Governor Malloy's education policies and also Governor Malloy's economic development policies, which he has called corporate welfare. What's your reaction to John Pelto's bid for governor?
Well, surprisingly, I actually agree with John Pelto on those two issues. I think with respect to our schools are still underperforming. We have the largest achievement gap in, of any state in the country, which is inexcusable. And I think that Governor Malloy had some what I call education reform light, where he made some proposals for some initiatives, but they really weren't ones that were going to have a large impact. And in the end, he didn't fight hard to have them funded. So his commitment to education since he's been governor is actually less than it was under Governor Rellin and governors prior to him. So I think those are legitimate criticisms. I also, interestingly, am against the corporate welfare. I think we're spending billions of taxpayer money to, in many cases, very large profitable corporations in order to get them not to take jobs out of the state. When if the governor were somebody who were more pro-business and could send a stronger message about supporting employers here, you wouldn't need to pay those billions to keep them from leaving.
And we're going to talk a little bit about economic development in a bit. I do want to turn to education just to start. And off the top, as we talk about John Pelto's candidacy, I'll just ask a quick political question, which is it seems a widely accepted belief that if a third-party candidate who's a known liberal is going to run, that he may well take votes away from Governor Malloy. At the same time, you and he do agree on a lot of issues. You agree on a lot of the same criticisms of Governor Malloy. Are you worried that John Pelto is going to take votes away from Tom Foley?
No, because I think he is liberal and probably to the left of Governor Malloy. So I think it's much more likely that he would take votes away from Governor Malloy. I don't think he's going to be talking about messages and people who know him who are moderates and people in the middle. I don't think they would be voting for him.
It seems as though there is a lot of agreement, though, on some of the education policies that I've heard from both the right and the left that, for instance, the Common Core state standards adopted by a number of states, including Connecticut, are not the way forward for this state. John Pelto has said that he would repeal Common Core if he was governor. What would you do?
Well, my objection is that the governor mandated a lot of policy on schools statewide. And the true story is that most of the schools in Connecticut are excellent schools, some of the best schools in the country. So my theory is if it ain't broke, don't fix it. So why would they mandate Common Core, for example, and teacher evaluations and other things on schools that are doing very well under local control? So I think to require schools to use Common Core in school districts and schools where they're doing well was a mistake. And I would only focus on schools that are underperforming and having the state get involved there.
When you say the state get involved there, give me an outline of what that would look like. What would state involvement in low-performing schools be?
Well, I've supported, for example, in-district public school choice. So let the marketplace work a little bit. Let parents make these decisions. I think parents make better decisions about what's the right school for their children than school administrators do and elected officials. So first of all, provide that choice. But then we also need to provide parents information that they can work with. So I think we need a statewide school grading system, A through F. Let's not make it too complicated, because most parents are busy. They're working. They're taking care of their kids when they're not in school and so on and so forth, and they can't go do independent research. So having some grading system that takes pages and hours to study doesn't make sense. So let's get a simple grading system for schools so parents know, then give them choice, and have money follow the child, so we aren't continuing to fund schools that aren't performing well.
But what happens to an F school? I think one of the complaints from many in the education world, since No Child Left Behind and then a race to the top from the Obama administration, is that we punish poorly performing schools so much that we set them back even further. I mean, nobody wants to go to a school that's failing. Nobody wants to go to a school that's not going to get as many supports from the state. I mean, what do you do with an F school?
Well, there's something wrong with an F school. And I believe that there's a promise that America makes to everyone, and it's a premise that I think our social contract rests on, and that's fairness and opportunity. And if you aren't providing a decent education to young people, particularly in a state like Connecticut that has the resources, it's not fair. And there is an opportunity there for the people because there aren't jobs that they're qualified to fulfill when they get out of school. So, you know, you can make all these arguments and reasons why we shouldn't be doing this or shouldn't be doing that, but if you have a child that's in a school that's not giving them a decent education, you simply have to do something. You can't stick with what we're doing.
But what would you do? I mean, what specifically would you do to fix a failing
school?
I'm
not uncomfortable letting schools be reconstituted when parents are choosing to take their kids out of that school and move it to another school. I do think one thing with money follows the child is you have to childs have different needs, and those needs cost more or less money depending on the child. So we right now have a grant that's a per-child grant. It's a fixed grant. And I think that the grant, if you go to Money Follows the Child, the grant should be based on the child's needs. And I think the bigger complaint is that a lot of the most qualified, highly performing, easiest students to teach will migrate away from schools and to some schools, and schools will be left just with kids with special needs and who cost more to educate. So I think if you had a variable grant based on a child's needs, that problem would be addressed.
Do you support the expansion of charter schools in the state?
I think we have the lowest number of charter schools per capita for K through 12 children in the country, so that says something. I think charter schools, they're good charter schools, they're bad charter schools, but I think to the extent that we can have good charter schools, and in any way we can get good schools into this state that are doing a fair job educating young people, we should pursue. And I think charter schools is part of the answer. But we're never going to have enough charter schools to solve this problem. Fundamentally, we have about 100, between 100 and 120,000 K through 12 students are in underperforming schools. That's inexcusable. We have to do something about it. We're never going to solve that problem with charter schools. We have to do it within the current public school system.
Okay. Well, because one of the questions about charter schools is that, indeed, they often end up with those high-performing students, and then the neighborhood schools are left with students who have less ability to achieve. And so it makes the charter schools' performance look better. It makes the neighborhood schools' performance look worse.
I know that's a hit that's put on charter schools. Listen, there are people who have reasons to object to charter schools that have nothing to do with whether or not they're doing a good job, and they're out there and they're very vocal. But if you go and talk to Daisha Toll at Achievement First about the performance of Amistad Academy in New Haven, for example, she'll tell you that bias isn't there. That they have a lottery system. They don't control. They basically pick their students to come from the same background, same mix as the regular public schools kids.
We're talking with Tom Foley. He's a Republican candidate for governor, and we're going to take some of your questions in a moment at 860-275-7266. We're starting talking a little bit about education here. The governor just announced the expansion of preschool education by another 1,000 slots. He plans to increase the number by, I believe, 4,000 early education slots over the next few years. What's your plan for preschool education in the state?
Well, there's some very good results early on from the impact of preschool education. I definitely support that. Listen, there are an awful lot of families in Connecticut who are both parents are working or single parent homes. The parent is out working. A lot of families under financial stress and other kinds of stress that make it so that the environment at home is not as enriching as it is in other homes. And in those instances, I think what the data is showing is that the kids benefit a lot from a preschool program so that when they arrive in kindergarten or the regular school system or whatever age they start, they're better prepared. And if they start off behind or with a disadvantage, that gap just merely widens as they go on. So this makes a lot of sense, I think, for families that need it and can't afford it. Having the government provide this is a good idea.
So you'd be in favor of essentially funding a universal pre-K so that all kids could go to school in the state before kindergarten?
Well, you say universal pre-K. I think for families that need it and for families that can't afford it, it should be available. If that's what they mean by universal pre-K, then I support that.
Let's get to some phone calls. We're going to go to Bethy, who's calling from Glastonbury first. Hello there. You're on Where We Live with Tom Foley.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Foley.
Good morning.
I don't understand your position on the gun control law from articles that I've read. So can you be very specific about whether or not you support the law? And as governor, will you sign a bill to repeal Connecticut's gun legislation?
Yeah. Listen, I've been very clear about this, so I'll repeat it again. If I had been governor, the bill would have been very different. I think that the tragedy in Newtown, which was a tragedy we all shared, but particularly the families that were affected and that community, something definitely needed to be done. But in my view, that was a mental health case, and the source of the problem was a mental health issue. I have a sister who has mental health issues, and I've been very involved in her care for a long time. And so I know the challenge for families that are addressing family members with mental health issues, and there simply is not enough support either in the private sector care system or from the public sector. And this is an unfortunate development as state mental health institutions basically went out of business or were legally prohibited from caring for people with certain kinds of needs. And so that support simply isn't there. So that would have been my focus of the bill. I think that Governor Malloy overreached with this bill. I'm not quite sure why. I think a lot of the things that were in the bill would not prevent.
Be specific about the overreach. Well, what do you think is in the bill that shouldn't have been in the bill?
Well, there are an awful lot of things in there that inconvenience law-abiding citizens who believe they have a right under the Second Amendment to own and use firearms. What I said when this tragedy happened was that the government should address any solutions they can to make sure that something like this doesn't happen again. But there's an awful lot in that bill that had nothing to do with what happened in Newtown and wouldn't prevent another Newtown from happening.
But I was just asking for some specificity. I mean, is there something specific you can point to that says that's in there that I wouldn't have put in that bill?
Well, anything that is inconveniencing to law-abiding citizens who believe they have a right under the Second Amendment to bear firearms.
Do you think we should have background checks for gun purchases?
Well, listen, the weapons that were used in Newtown were all legally purchased. The ammunition was legally purchased. None of this would have prevented Newtown from happening. All I'm saying is that the action that was taken by public officials should have been addressed at preventing another Newtown from happening, and that's not what came out of this bill. There were an awful lot of things in there that had nothing to do with Newtown.
So how do you get at this nexus of mental health and gun control and making sure that Newtown doesn't happen again? Because I think a lot of people who err on one side say, you know, we need to have stronger mental health systems, and on the other side, people say we need to have fewer guns. Clearly, there needs to be some mix of these two things because the problem is someone with mental health issues having guns causing problems. So how exactly would that work in your mind in order to, you know, keep people who have mental health issues from having guns? What would that look like?
Well, I think the people are misfocused. Listen, we've had a lot of tragedies similar to Newtown since then. And
I believe 74 school shootings since that time across the country.
They aren't all shootings. Some of these are stabbings.
No, 74 shootings.
Oh, so okay. Well, yeah. But I mean, all the tragedies aren't just shootings. The one that happened in Southern California, the three young men that were killed in his apartment were stabbed. So, you know, I don't think anyone's proposing getting rid of knives. So, listen, I think we have a cultural problem. We certainly have a mental health problem. In every one of these cases, there are indications of serious mental health issues that appear before these things happen. So, I don't. not sure why the focus is solely on guns, because I think it's more about people.
But the question I'm asking you is, let's say you identify someone who has mental health problems and who owns guns. What do you do?
Well, Adam Lanza didn't own guns.
His mother owned guns.
His mother owned guns.
He lived in a house with guns. Well, you get the point that I'm trying to ask you is, how do we actually take our mental health policy and our gun policy and try to figure out some way to make sure that instances like Newtown, but also like the thing that just happened in Las Vegas and the thing that just happened in Oregon, and it keeps happening. I mean, you and me and everyone else looks at it on the news, and I think we have the same feeling, Tom Foley. I can't believe this just happened again, right? And that's got to be how you look at it.
Absolutely.
So how do we keep this from happening again?
It's very – well, that's what I'm saying. These are all mental health cases. I think we need to figure out ways to help families – first of all, to identify people who have mental health problems that make them a risk to society, and to help families when these problems emerge. I think people's families know about these risks and problems sooner than anybody else. So there needs to be a way for these people to be able to reach out and seek help. And I don't think there's enough help there. I don't, from my own experience, I know. It's very hard for families, first of all, to get their hands around what's really going on and to find experts who can help them assess what the situation is and where they can get help. That's where I would focus it, not on taking weapons away from law-abiding citizens who have no intent of using them with any harm to anyone.
I'll just ask one last question of this, but what about the number of guns in America right now and the fact that clearly with so many guns – some are in the hands of people who have mental health problems. How do you deal with that?
Well, there's probably a bigger problem with guns in this country. The Newtown tragedy was a terrible tragedy, but there are a lot more young people that are being killed with illegally owned guns in our cities. You know that.
I do know that. We cover that every day. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So I think the focus should be on figuring out ways to get guns out of the hands of people who own them illegally and not people who own them legally. I don't really think
even people who have mental health problems that we can clearly identify through talking to their family members, whatever. Essentially, you're saying the problem with illegal guns is a bigger problem than the problem of people who have mental health issues with guns.
Well, most state laws already have some kind of a provision for making it so that people with certain mental health problems can't purchase weapons and ammunition.
The second part of Bethy's question, would you repeal the current law if you were governor?
Listen, I think that's a fixed law right now. People have asked me if the legislature came to me with some modifications to the law. Most laws are corrections and modifications over time. It was a pretty comprehensive bill. If the legislature came to me with some changes that made it less inconvenient for law-abiding citizens who own firearms, I would sign that. But a full repeal of the bill seems very unlikely.
Tom Foley is our guest. He's a Republican candidate for governor. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to a lot of your phone calls. Many people want to join the conversation. Our phone number, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at wherewelive. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're giving you a chance to ask questions of Tom Foley. He's a Republican candidate for governor. He's the front runner right now in that race. We're giving you a chance at 860-275-7266 in our series Where We Vote. So let's go to John in Plainville. Hi there, John.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, not too bad. What's on your mind?
Right now I just want to ask, Connecticut's economy used to be one of the strongest in the country. Now it's probably one of the weakest. How did this happen, and what is Tom going to do to change it?
John, thanks very much for the question. Well, a lot of things. You're right. We have one of the worst job recovery records since the recession of any state in the country, and I think it's because of the policies of the government and Governor Malloy. I think all the messages and the policy direction has been wrong for the state, and we're starting. I think people are becoming convinced that that's the case. We had a very large tax increase when Governor Malloy first became governor. That hurt the economy. It's cost us jobs. And yet his failure to get control over spending has resulted in that tax increase being squandered. He talks about cutting spending, but he's actually not telling the truth on that because he's talking about cutting from what's called the current services budget, which actually is usually a 7 or 8% increase every year. So spending actually has gone up about 4.5% a year while Governor Malloy's been governor, or over $3 billion, about 15%. So first thing we have to do is we have to get control over spending. I've said I'll hold spending flat for 2 years so we can catch up and get spending back down to a level that's affordable for the citizens of Connecticut. And then I'm talking about tax reform. I think we need to relieve the tax burden on the citizens who are most challenged. I've proposed taking 0.5% off the sales tax. That's the most regressive tax we have in Connecticut. It's the one that hurts working families the most, the people who are on a budget. And I think it'll do the most to stimulate the economy and help start getting us headed back in the right direction on jobs. We simply have to make the state more business-friendly. I talked about a red tape review where we look at all the burdens we put on not just businesses but individuals with paperwork, regulations, requirements for getting permits and so on and so forth. I think Connecticut's going way beyond the pale and all of that. We have a lot of things that tie up businesses, and it just causes them to throw up their hands and say, I'm out of here. I'm moving to a more friendly place. It doesn't need to be that unfriendly. We obviously need regulations. We need to protect the public assets. But I think we're going way beyond what's needed to do that in the interest of good public policy.
The governor has pledged to balance next year's budget without any new taxes. Given the fact that we face some pretty big deficits in the next couple of years, whoever the next governor is going to have to deal with them. Are you absolutely confident that you will not have to raise any taxes on anyone in order to close this gap?
Yes.
You won't raise
because
any taxes.
We don't have a revenue problem in Connecticut. We have a spending problem. And this governor, he said last time that his tax increase would solve the problem. It hasn't. We're projecting somewhere between $1.4 and $1.6 billion deficits next year and every year after that. So he promised that, and it didn't happen. He promised he would never sign a budget that wasn't in accordance with GAAP. And he's every budget he signed since he was governor is not in accordance with GAAP. So this governor has a tendency to say things that turn out not to be true. And so I don't know why people would rely on that kind of an assurance.
We're maybe walking down the same road here, but is that the way you'd run the books? Would you work the state's budgets according to GAAP or generally accepted accounting principles?
Listen, I'm not a career politician, and one of my disappointments with the governor and the government here in Connecticut is I don't think they're very straightforward with ordinary citizens. I think there's a lot of game playing with the numbers, and I think strong leaders and responsible people in leadership positions don't twist the facts, don't try and paint a picture that isn't accurate about what's going on. Listen, we're elected. This is a democracy. We're elected by ordinary citizens, and if they elect you, you have an obligation to take the knowledge you have and tell them truthfully what's going on. And I don't think that's what's happened. And it's not just Governor Malloy. I mean, this is I think the legislature is complicit in this. But Governor Malloy seems to have a particular knack for, I've talked about Malloy math. You know, the math just doesn't work out. This governor says things that mathematically are known not to be true.
Well, could I just ask you the question again? Would you operate under generally accepted accounting principles under your administration?
Yes, I would seek to move the state to GAAP accounting. I think but listen, there are an awful lot of other things that are. It's being truthful to the citizens about the condition of the state and what it's going to take to get things turned around.
How would you approach state labor unions about work rules and pensions, health benefits? How would you go to them and ask for something? Because clearly you would need some help from them in order to close this budget gap.
Well, listen, a deal's a deal. And this governor cut a deal with the unions with respect to their health benefits and health and retirement benefits. And as far as I'm concerned, a deal's a deal. So I don't think you can change that. But with respect to new employees, with respect to future contracts that we would enter into, I would obviously sit down and want to work out with the public unions an agreements that work for the state. But, John, I think the size of that problem is not totally understood by people because the budget, only a third of the budget is related to the costs of public employees. So you're not going to solve the spending problems on the backs of our public employees. No matter how hard you try, they're not going to solve it for you. So really the solutions are in other areas. Government serves a legitimate purpose. You need people to do that. So public employees are very much a part of government.
But where do the savings come then? A third is a pretty big chunk. I mean, where do the savings come?
Well, a big part of – another third of our budget is related to health care costs. So Medicaid, retirement benefits for former public employees and current public employees. So the state has an awful lot of leverage to control the cost of delivering health care services. And listen, the state's pretty inefficient at how it delivers health care services. It's one of the premises of Obamacare, was to bring down the cost of delivering health care. I don't think it's going to do that because I think Obamacare has many aspects to it that are actually going to drive costs up. But I think the state in Connecticut can do a lot to reduce the cost of delivering health care services. So if you need a bypass surgery, and today it costs, who knows what, $100,000 to do that, I think there are ways to lower the cost of delivering those health care services. So that if you could take 5 or 10% off the cost of health care services in New York, and I'm not talking about changing people's benefits. I'm just talking about how efficiently hospitals work and doctors and the whole health care delivery system. You could go a long way toward addressing the spending problem.
But, I mean, how do you do that, though? I mean, are you saying that hospitals are just charging people too much money? Are you going to go after the hospitals and say you've got to make sure that you're providing lower cost care?
Well, I think one way to do it would be to give consumers more information about what things cost. You know, we have largely a third party paying system. So if you have a healthcare problem and you're insured, and your doctor tells you to go get an MRI, and you know you don't really care so much where you get that MRI. You're probably going to go get it at the place that's closest to your home, right? But an MRI in some places in Connecticut costs upwards of $8,000. In other places, it costs less than $4,000. So nobody's making these intelligent choices about cost. Now, when you're a customer as large as the state of Connecticut is, you can do that, and you can affect the marketplace, and you can drive business to people who are more efficient at delivering those services. So I do think the state can do a lot to lower health care costs.
But it almost sounds – I mean, the state has all that leverage. I mean, maybe – I don't know, maybe some sort of a state-run single-payer health care system works. I mean, you could run Medicaid for all. Doesn't that – I mean,
you said the states
could have a lot of leverage. Maybe you could help bring down the cost of health care.
Part of a market is having multiple suppliers and multiple customers. And so if you go to a single-party payer system, then you don't have multiple customers. You have one customer, and that's a monopoly. And we eliminated monopolies a long time ago in America because they don't support competitive markets.
Well, let's just get back to this hospital piece, though. So you said that, yes, more information for patients, but still the costs are too high in some hospitals. What do you think is driving the costs so high in hospitals? If you're talking about state leverage, why don't you go to the hospitals? I mean, a lot of them, they're nonprofits, and so they're not paying any real taxes to the state or to their local municipality. Some of the CEOs of these hospitals make millions and millions of dollars. They expand and build new facilities all over the place. Could you go to the hospitals and say, look, you guys need to bring down the cost of delivering care? That's where we need to save money, and that's what I'm asking for as governor.
Yeah, well, you can't just say that. I mean, you have to work with them to figure out how to do it. And the state drives up costs by mandating an awful lot of things on hospitals, the healthcare system, insurers, so on and so forth. And some of that's well intended, but ends up costing people an awful lot of money. So, you know, there are all kinds of things. Just because something is nonprofit doesn't mean it's efficient. And in many cases, nonprofits are far less efficient than for-profit enterprises. So, I come out of the private sector. This is what I did for 30 years, and I was very successful at it. In the private sector, you have to be competitive so people understand. I mean, even our state government, this current services budget, it's ridiculous to me that in government, the governor and as goes to all the departments and says, well, if we do the same thing next year that we did this year, what's it going to cost? And, of course, they say, well, 7 or 8% more. And So they cut 2% off of that, and everything goes up by 4, 5, 6%. And everybody says they've cut, and then they spend that much more money, and they do the same thing. In the private sector, when you're running a company, the CEO comes to the departments and says, listen, we're going to make more widgets next year, or we're going to provide more services. And guess what? We got to do it for less money because our competitors are out there, and they're going to be doing it for less money. So how can we reduce cost? And government just doesn't do that. So that's
But that CEO can then say, you know what? In order to reduce cost, we got to lay off 2,000 people out of our company. I mean, is it one of the things that people are asking and I think want to know about is would you lay off people in state government if you had to?
That's what I'm saying.
You're not going to lay off people in state government.
No. The state workers are only a third of the cost of government. So even if you know, that's not going to solve the problem. But, John, you and I know government actually does things. You know?
Oh, trust me, yeah.
But the problem with this government is they aren't doing enough, and government's costing too much. People are getting a bad deal. Their taxes have gone up, and everybody knows that roads and bridges are deteriorating. We've got the second longest wait in lines at DMV of any state in the country. I think we're a minute or two behind California, and it's like 53 and a half minutes. This is just a government that's not performing. So it's not only expensive. We not only have some of the highest taxes anywhere in the country and the highest spending rate per capita and the highest long-term liabilities per capita, but the government simply isn't performing well. So everybody assumes that if you're going to hold spending – I'm not saying I'm going to cut spending. I'm saying I'm going to hold spending flat. So, hey, if we employed everybody in the state government this year – that we have with the spending, we can do it next year spending the same amount of money.
Don't costs go up? Costs go up for everything. You run a business. I mean, costs go up.
They go up in some areas and they go down in some areas. So you have to make it more efficient. This government wastes a tremendous amount of money.
Well, let's get to some phone calls. Scott's in Hartford. You're on with Tom Foley. Scott.
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question. When you look at Wisconsin and they ended collective bargaining in the public sector, and they wiped out a multi-billion-dollar deficit. Now they have a surplus. It seems like right-to-work states are growing much faster than we are. What is your stance on that? I mean, collective bargaining, and do you think or do you see that as standing in the way of having a more efficient government that you just spoke of?
Thanks, Scott.
Actually, I don't. I've talked about a Wisconsin moment in Connecticut, and my opponents have tried to make it sound like I'm have a plan for making Connecticut a right-to-work state. The Wisconsin moment I was talking about was when we went from a Democrat governor and a Democrat legislature over to both being Republican in one cycle. And I hope that happens. I think it might be a little bit of wishful thinking, but I think we can get a large part of the way there in November. Listen, this unions serve a useful purpose. They've been active and functional in Connecticut and particularly in the public sector for a long time. I think it would be a wrong move for somebody to try and significantly change the collective bargaining arrangements and everything we have in Connecticut. And I don't think it would be successful if somebody tried it. I think it wouldn't be supported politically. So that may have worked in Wisconsin. I don't think it's something that would be useful or politically effective here.
Let's go to Mike, who's in West Haven. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call. Hello, Mr. Foley.
Hi.
Just had a question in regards to the state pension fund and how do you plan on keeping it funded? And also, being that some contracts will expire for state workers, how do you feel about continuing collective bargaining with the state workers and unions?
I think we just answered the collective bargaining question, but I am interested about funding the state pensions. Mike, thank you very much.
Yeah, well, listen, you have to. These are long-term obligations that the state has made and must keep. As I said earlier, a deal's a deal. So what we need to do is make sure that we aren't spending money or wasting money in other areas so we can fund these pensions. And that's one of my objections here. Because Governor Malloy has failed to get control over spending, he's taking money out of the special transportation fund. So our roads and bridges aren't being maintained, and funds are not, therefore, available to fund these pension obligations. And we simply have to do it. So the answer number one is that you got to get control over spending so you have money that can be directed toward the things that are most needed, like funding our pensions, fixing our schools, repairing our roads and bridges, reducing the lines at DMV, reducing traffic congestion, all the things that hurt people in the state of Connecticut.
We've got a roads and bridges question, actually, from Chuck in Greenwich for Tom Foley. Hi there, Chuck. Go ahead.
Yes, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. My question is in regards to the recent bridge failure in Norwalk. I wanted to know what the state's role is and what could have been done differently to avoid incidents like this in the future.
Well, I just mentioned the Special Transportation Fund. We have a Special Transportation Fund that was meant to be protected funds that come largely from the gas tax and are meant to maintain and improve our roads and bridges. That is a state-owned asset, and that's something that the state should have been maintaining. It obviously hasn't been. And the reason is we've been taking money out of that Special Transportation Fund to fund general expenses, which, as I've said, have been out of control. And Governor Malloy has failed to get control over spending. So, this goes back. I think that was a 118-year-old bridge, so we can't blame the whole thing on Governor Malloy. But listen, his predecessors, too, have failed to get control over spending. We simply have to do that. It's taking the state in the wrong direction.
What do we do with those assets, those rail assets that we have? We had on Jim Cameron, who is a commuter advocate, on our program yesterday talking about that bridge failure. And he's been long saying, maybe the state should sell its train tracks, its bridges, everything that it owns right now to Amtrak. Let them deal with the maintenance because they're the ones that have got to run hundreds and hundreds of trains a day on it. What do you think?
Listen, when businesses start selling assets to solve financial problems, that's kind of a death spiral. That's what people do when they're insolvent. I think the state shouldn't be selling assets to cover current operating expenses, which is what's happening. I also, I think the government of the state of Connecticut could be doing an awful lot better job than what they're doing, but I'm not sure they're doing a worse job than Amtrak, I think.
But what do we do if we can't maintain the tracks that we have, if we can't maintain the bridges that we have? I mean, we're coming to a little bit of a head here.
Sure.
We were joking on the show yesterday about the fact that, it's a 118-year-old bridge. You can't blame any one person, and you certainly can't blame Governor Malloy for that. That all said, we don't really have a plan in this state to replace all of this stuff. How do you do it?
Well, listen, we are spending money on things other than investing in our infrastructure. Everybody can see this. You drive around Connecticut, all our bridges are rusting. They haven't been painted for years. The roads are we have potholes. We need paving. They don't have adequate shoulders. They're really in terrible shape. And all our infrastructure we're underinvesting in it. And so government is – state government and our federal government have gone from investing in roads, infrastructure, our highway system, airports, things that were going on 50 years ago, which, listen, had a very large stimulus on the economy, made things more efficient, businesses, people's time, and so on and so forth. Now we're spending money on things that aren't investments. It's current spending. And we simply need to shift some of that away from current spending and wasting money, and there's an awful lot of waste in government, and start reinvesting. We have to invest in our schools and we have to invest in our infrastructure, and that will help the economy, it will create jobs, and it will provide a better future for everyone in Connecticut.
A last thing before we take a break. Tomorrow on the program we're going to be talking about plans for tolls or congestion pricing on roadways, something to maybe raise revenue in order to fix the roads, but more importantly, make sure that the roads like 95 through Fairfield County aren't so congested. Do you support efforts or thoughts like that that have worked in places like Florida, Minnesota, California to impose some sort of congestion pricing scheme on the highways?
Well, I certainly have thought of ways of trying to reduce traffic congestion. It's very aggravating in Connecticut. It slows people down. It takes people away from their families. If you have to sit in traffic for 45 minutes a day, some people sit a lot longer. You're away from your children. We talk about pre-K enrichment programs. If a mother is stuck in traffic somewhere for an hour a day and that takes her away from her children and providing that enrichment, or a dad, that's a shame. That's a significant cost. So if we can reduce traffic congestion, we definitely should, and there are a lot of different ways we can do it. But I have read with interest where that's been done. Now, you can do this electronically so people don't have to stop at tolls. And So people put the most wear and tear on the system, some kind of user fee or some way of making it – some cost associated with using the roadways that are congested at times when they're congested is certainly something we ought to look at.
Oh, we're talking with Tom Foley. He's a Republican candidate for governor. When we come back, we'll take more of your phone calls at 860-275-7266. It's our Where We Vote series, and this is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, it's been about 30 years since Connecticut got rid of highway tolls. But there is talk about bringing them back, this time in the form of congestion pricing. It's what people call tolls these days. We'll take a look at what this is and see how it might be implemented here in Connecticut. That's our conversation tomorrow. Today we're talking with Tom Foley. He's a Republican candidate for governor. It's our Where We Vote series, giving you a chance to ask questions of the candidates here. We have an email from Betty. Would you sign a bill that legalized it's an act concerning compassionate aid in dying for terminally ill patients. In essence, this bill, she writes, would allow competent adults to self-administer medication prescribed by their attending physician to bring about his or her death.
Very, very complicated issue. I think that, listen, there are certainly people at a stage in their life where they don't want to continue on. They don't want to continue to be a burden on their families and so on and so forth. But how you determine when that's really what the person's wishes are versus maybe they aren't seeking that end is very complicated. And I think to just simply leave it in the hands of a family member and a physician would be a mistake. I think you need a little more scrutiny.
One of the things that I wanted to bring up to you, well, a few different things having to do with this political season quickly. You don't have a running mate yet.
Well, we have a complicated system here in Connecticut where the governor doesn't determine who his or her running mate is. We have a separate race, separate primary this time on the Republican side for lieutenant governor. And there are three qualified candidates, and I'm watching the race closely. I think they're all excellent. Any one of them I would be happy to run with and serve with, but the voters in a primary will decide who that's going to be.
Two of your the other gentlemen who are running, Mark Boughton and John McKinney, have both aligned themselves with candidates. I guess I was just wondering why you haven't decided at this point to do that.
Well, as I said, it's a complicated system, and I think there's a legacy of governors, candidates for governor aligning themselves with a candidate to be on a ticket the way it happens nationally. But in Connecticut, the system's different. Our primary is after our convention, whereas in the national races for president, the convention is after the primary. So, and it's the candidate for president, there's no separate primary for VP. So the candidate for president actually picks his running mate or her running mate. And that's not the way it works here in Connecticut, but that's the way it used to work. So I think there's still a notion, there's kind of conventional wisdom that you should pick a running mate, but that never made sense to me because the voters decide who that's going to be.
Well, why did you decide to go with public campaign financing this time around?
Yeah. Well, last time I didn't because the laws were quite different then. As you know, the grant was about less than half of what it is today. And they've also made it more difficult for people to run under the old traditional financing way. Fewer people can give. And the amounts and ways people can spend money have been further restricted because the legislature has an interest in forcing is probably the wrong word, but providing the incentives so that people will use the public financing system. And they've done a pretty good job. So all I seek is a level playing field with Governor Malloy. I know that if I have the same resources available to me to get my message out and talk to people about what I'll do leading Connecticut, that I will beat Governor Malloy. And I was convinced once he signed up to be in the system and a couple of other uncertainties were eliminated that I would have a level playing field if I signed up for the public financing. That's all I need. And so I signed up.
James is in New Britain. Hi, James.
Hi there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I'm a recent college grad. One thing I'm concerned about is the lack of opportunities in Connecticut. I don't want to have to leave the state to get a job, but I think I might have to. Just wondered why is that and what can we do?
James, thanks very much for the question. I don't want you to leave Connecticut, and I don't think you should leave Connecticut. You know, there was a recent poll that said 49% of the people in Connecticut were either considering or wished they lived in a different state. listen, things aren't that bad. But with new leadership and leadership pointing in a different direction and solving some of these problems that people see and don't see any solutions for, it is all a question of leadership. So, listen, when I'm governor, I'm going to be pointing in a different direction. I'm going to have solutions for these problems. We're going to get control over spending. We're going to get jobs back here in the state. And I'll have a very positive message, and I'll be bringing together the resources, and I think I'll be able to persuade people that this is a place where there's opportunity. This is a place where young people want to stay and invest in a career and otherwise buy a home and raise their families. And I truly believe that. But I think we need new leadership and a new direction.
Over the course of the next couple months, I think the candidates for governor are going to be saying a lot of things about each other's record. I just want to read you something that we read recently. This was a statement that Chris Cooper, who works for you now, made when he worked for your opponent, Mike Fedeli. He said, whether it's exaggerating the facts about his time in Iraq or grossly distorting his business record, Foley has shown a deeply troubling pattern of misrepresenting the facts about his life and career. Later, he says, given this pattern of serial distortion, short of full disclosure, voters in the media should regard his claims in these matters with a high degree of skepticism. What do you think he meant by that statement? He said that back in 2010 when he was working for the other guy.
He was working for an opponent. That sounds more like the Democratic State Party.
It does, kind of, doesn't it?
Vitriol. Yeah, I think that's kind of comes with politics. But you know what? That sounds like somebody doesn't have a message to sell to voters. If you're doing personal attacks on your opponent, and I served honorably in Iraq. I was awarded for my service. I left my family to do that. I was proud to do it, and I served honorably in every way. For anybody to call that into question, it means they have a bankrupt message. They simply can't talk about their records or the future in a constructive way that's going to convince voters to support them. So I think that might have been what was going on in the race that he was working for.
Well, the reason I bring it up is it is in some ways just politics. But the problem is that we had that the last time you were here. We talked an awful lot about some accusations you'd made about Governor Malloy, some things you said about him.
They were all true.
And that's but that's yeah. I think at the time three out of four were true. We had this conversation.
Well,
I guess the question is, as we think about who we should vote for, we hear your campaign spokesman saying that about you just 4 years ago, okay?
Well,
why should we believe anything that anybody says about anybody, Tom Foley, just given what we just heard from the guy who's working for you?
Well, he was a spokesman, so he wasn't saying that himself. He was speaking on behalf of his candidate. So that was Mike Fedeli.
He was speaking on behalf of his candidate, but he obviously believed it. Now he's
no, he didn't. No, spokesmen don't necessarily believe what they're asked to say.
I should ask Chris about that.
They're a spokesman. They're not saying what they believe. They're saying what their campaign asked them to say.
in the last minute, I guess the reason I ask this is John McKinney talked about this, about wanting to have a campaign in which we don't talk bad about the other guy. The last time we had you on, you were making some accusations about Governor Malloy. What type of tone would you like to set? We just have about 30 seconds left, John.
Well, listen, the first of all, the conversation has to be constructive for voters. It has to be information that voters can use to make a decision. I think talking about things that happened years and years ago or things that are speculative and can't be shown to be true are not constructive. I think but anything related to policy or somebody's record in public service or Governor Malloy's record is going to be very much for better or for worse. There are a lot of things I'm going to hit him on.
And that's a lot of what we're going to be talking about over the next few months. Tom Foley, good to see you again. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you, John. Always a pleasure.
This is Where We Live.